It is Saturday, September 28th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Public Radio 889 and KOSP.org. It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Ben Jaffe, who's been not here for quite a while. Hi, Ben.
Hey there.
How's it doing?
I'm great.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
And
we also have Lindsay Lonnie. Hi, Lindsay. Welcome back.
Thanks. Well,
good to see you. Systems analyst, support engineer, and software engineer, and Ben Jaffe, who's a web instructor and world traveler. I've had you both on the show many times, but we also have someone we've never had on the show again before, Roger Jaffe, father of Mr. Ben Jaffe. Roger is a high school math and engineering teacher, a software engineer, and a freelance programmer. Roger, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So we're going to jump right into the news, but before we do news, I thought it would be kind of interesting to hear what the state of the art in high school math and engineering looks like. What are you doing with technology in your classroom?
Oh, my classroom is the geekiest classroom at my school. I've done what's in education circles called flipping the classroom, not a term that I particularly care for, but basically my lectures are on video and students watch the videos at home, and I can take a 40-minute lecture in class and turn it into about a 12-minute video because lecturing in class is rather inefficient. And so this way they can watch it. If they have questions, problems, they can rewind it. They can go and watch it again. Or if they're good with it, they can just zip right through it and, you know, they're good to go. When they come into class, that's where their homework is, and which is it works out well because typically kids go home, they do homework, and they get stuck, and then there's no one to ask.
Sure.
So when they're in class, they do their homework, and they can ask me. And so I've brought in, they've got laptops. They use the laptops every day. I put my entire course on Google Sites, all my resources on Google Docs. They can share all those documents.
So in Google Sites, of course, it's like an application environment where kind of it makes an environment that has all the Google support, but it's not public necessarily. It's more like an internal
app. No, it can be part of it is public, but most of it is not. And so students have to be in my class to get access to the course content.
So the flipping the classroom idea is really the idea that the time that you spend actually learning the material, which would normally be homework time, you're doing that in class. And everybody comes in with the base knowledge. And this, when I was leaving the University of California, Santa Cruz, that was a common tactic for some of the faculty that I was actually really impressed with, that they would basically record their lectures. The lectures would be playable for them. And then it was more like individual sessions, the actual class time instead of a lecture.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's how it is in my classroom, too.
Now, do you find that students are watching the videos?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had extremely positive feedback. And we have a couple other teachers doing the same thing now, and they're getting the same feedback that I've gotten. Just that, you know, the kids like it, and they respond to it. And when I have them asking me, you know, hey, this problem that we're doing in class, can you put a solution online so I can watch it? You know, when they're asking me to do this, then, you know, you figure you're onto something.
Right. They clearly want more.
Correct. Yeah.
I never actually had that experience with any of the teachers that I had in high school, except with my AP Calculus teacher who, by chance, happened to be my dad.
the same
gentleman.
Yeah, yes. Which it was a fantastic class, I think. You're a brilliant teacher.
Thank you.
But I was also lucky in that being at home, I always had two supportive parents who would help me with my homework, right?
Right.
But if you're in a situation where you don't necessarily have two supportive parents or one supportive parent who will help you with your homework, then you get stuck, you know? And so
Well, Roger, what about people that don't have computers at home? I mean, Did you know that 15% of U.S. Americans, adult Americans, do not use the computer?
Yes.
I mean, that's a big percentage. Therefore, some students must have trouble with that. Right?
And the ways that we work around it, at least at our school and other schools where people do this, students who don't have computers, or a lot of times students have computers but don't have internet or don't have fast internet.
Right.
You know, we probably have 300 computers on campus in computer labs and stuff, and, you know, go pick one, you can watch it. I put my videos on flash drives, and I let a student take it. They dump it all in their computer, and now they've got all the videos.
Oh, yeah, I like that idea. I think that's a lot better for video.
You know, do the same thing on a DVD.
Now, isn't this a lot of work, though? I mean, you have to take all your lectures that you normally can do off the... I mean, you've been a teacher for years, so these lectures are something like you look at the page, you're like, okay, I can do this. You've got notes and everything.
Right.
So it's pretty easy for you to do it in front of a classroom to some degree, and you say it's faster as a video, but isn't it take time for you to make these videos?
It does. It probably takes... It takes about an hour to do a 15-minute video just to stop and start and prepare mm-hmm. your screen. And I'm actually not on the video. It's a video of my desktop.
Yeah,
on
it's
my
a screencast.
Computer. It's yeah. a screencast. But there's a lot, of, you know, some post-production work and some editing, and I tend to use words a lot that I probably shouldn't, so I take those out. But
sometimes me and my siblings would have yes. fun with him because he'll be in the corner of the living room. That's where his desk is, recording all these lectures. And, you know, we're just hanging out doing our things. And so occasionally we'll come by and mess with him or make silly faces or whatever, get yes. him to laugh.
And sometimes I leave him in because the students like to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, once it's done, it's done. You know, I typically teach the same courses every year, and so I did my statistics course 3 years ago, and now I'm just fine-tuning it mm-hmm. and you know, editing a little bit.
And, of course, after they've watched it, you have a chance the next day to actually spend some more
Absolutely.
Quality time with the students and maybe change something and go, oh, by the way, last night's video, this is what's going on, but there's a clarification here. And mm-hmm. so, of course, it's not like it's not like an online course 100% at all. Right. That's pretty cool. We're talking with Roger Jaffe. He's actually Ben Jaffe's father. And we're talking about his teaching in high school. He teaches technology. He teaches high school math and engineering. And also, do you teach software engineering as well to high school?
Next year.
Oh, good.
We're going to be starting AP Computer Science next year, yes.
Do you know the movement code.org? Do you know that website?
No, I
okay.
don't.
Take a look at code.org. It's a initiative to have everybody learn computer programming like everyone learns math and English. In the United States. That's the initiative. I strongly believe that, and if you've heard the show many times, I'm sure you're a dedicated listener to your son's radio show, that I believe strongly that being literate in computer programming in this day and age is akin to reading 100 years ago. You know, you mm-hmm. basically, you need to understand at a more complicated level to be an active member of society and not just a passive one. Okay, let's move on. Ben, did you have something else to say? You took a breath?
Right. Oh, no. No, right. I was just breathing. I was just respirating.
So your father does videos. He does engineering. He does very geeky things. Is this where this all came from for you?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think it's in my genes.
Yeah,
know?
Definitely.
Music as well, you know.
All right. Lindsay, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What's happening this week in birthday celebrations of tech?
So there's two pretty big birthdays, at least in my opinion, this week. Google celebrated 15 years with a new Easter egg. So their Easter eggs are, you know, things they hide that if you know a certain thing to search for, it pops up and you can go explore. So Friday was their 15-year anniversary of when two Stanford students launched their project to kind of aggregate things on the internet.
Yeah. To conquer the world.
To conquer the world, right. And they were kind of competing with, you know, Yahoo, Alta Vista, Lycos, Hotbot, Dogpile, and all the other ones that were at the time.
That was the one.
Yeah. I haven't heard those names in such a long time.
Right?
And they did, of course, the reason why Google was so successful is the basic thought of that, of let's rank pages by who are linking to who. And
yeah.
just basically use people to decide the solution, which seems like cheating, but it worked really well for them. I just was chatting with a friend who actually works at eHow and those big sites that produce a lot of content, and he talked about how much the financial incentive to succeed at Google ranking you well, how important that is in everything that's done online. And in chatting with him, I was really getting that, like, the company, it is completely, the company that he works for with 300 employees is completely reliant on an algorithm of Google's that cannot actually be read. It's hidden, it's secret, and it, at a change of that, can drastically change their company. In fact, put them out of business.
Right.
Right? And it's the powerhouse that their algorithms have emerged. And of course, there's whole units in Google dedicated to improving it all the time. And improving it is, let's make computers smart enough to determine what's good stuff to read.
Yeah.
Right? And how does a computer algorithm know that? And it's just nasty.
A sidetrack on that is they also released Hummingbird.
That's one of the things he was talking about. Yeah, tell me about Hummingbird.
They released the hummingbirds.
Exactly.
The birds. I actually haven't heard about this, so I'm really interested too.
Yeah, it's basically just their new algorithm. And from what I can tell, it affects blogs mostly. So when you're reading blog information, It tries to be more intelligent about the things that socially are more important to people.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's closed. You can't know what the algorithm is and what's changed. So if you have a blog and you had a ranking, you might want to go back and check what your ranking is now.
Yeah. Well, and so this ties in very much, like, the decisions that engineers are making at this large company are changing the finances of billions of dollars, right?
Yeah.
Just by these algorithms. And that you have to understand computer programming to even understand what the context of that space is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
you can't understand the actual code because it's
secret, yeah.
But having a background or even just some understanding of computer programming allows you to comprehend the basics of the arena in which all of this happens, which is
very
I
well
think,
said, Mr. Jaffe.
Thank you very much.
Let's do one more birthday announcement. I like this one too.
Sure. Well, I have to tell you what the Easter egg is.
What's
the Easter egg?
So you type in Google in 1998 into Google search.
Okay.
And it shows you what you would have seen in 1998 if you searched for the word Google on Google. So it shows you the old search rankings and stuff like that. And it shows you the old logo. So you get to see all the old 1998. And then at the top of the page, it'll say, go back to 2013. And you can go back to
I remember these
search.
Pages.
Yeah, aww. Exactly.
Font choices and everything.
The big bubbly font.
Yep. And apparently there were other Easter eggs, like do a barrel roll and ponies, and you can YouTube those. But I don't remember those. I'm going to have to go check them out. And the new birthday, so there's another one, and it actually is new, GNU.
pronounced new.
Yeah.
But
GNU.
I would say GNU. GNU.
GNU.
New.
GNU.
It's GNU.
Do you remember Gary GNU? Do you GNU? Okay.
What?
It was an old Cartoon Network thing. So they turned 30.
Geek.
Yeah, exactly. So GNU Linux turned 30 this week.
And what does GNU stand for?
It's, I don't have this written down.
GNU is not
GNU's
Unix.
GNU's not Unix.
Right.
Yes,
GNU. So it's a self-referential acronym.
Yeah.
GNU's not Unix.
Yeah. And do you want to read the little... the announcement that he wrote on...
It was kind of cool.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to read it?
Yeah. So okay. RMS, which is Stallman, Richard Stallman,
yeah.
We've had on Geekspeak. You want to listen to Richard Stallman chat with us on Geekspeak? You can find that at geekspeak.org.
Like a year and a half ago?
Longer than that, I think.
Two?
So he wrote 30 years ago, "Free Unix. Starting this Thanksgiving, I'm going to write a complete Unix-compatible software system called GNU for GNU's not Unix and give it away for free to everyone who can use it. Contributions to time, money, programs and equipment are greatly needed." And that was the start of the free software movement, basically. The operating system, it didn't actually win in a lot of sense. It's not really as alive. But all the apps that were built up in that time are very used in the Linux environment. And actually, they've migrated all over the place. So some of these tools actually exist on the Macintosh as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea behind free software in the way that Stallman talks about is really, you should be able to see the source code, you should be able to change it, and in changing it, you participate publicly with the changes you've made to share those as well. So it's like a forced public sharing. And he definitely feels that way. And in chatting with him, he's dogmatic about that, actually, which somebody has to be, I guess. Anyway, thank you for the 30 years of GNU, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, they're having, FSF is holding an anniversary celebration and hackathon at MIT this weekend. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know, there are very few things in the computing space that can say that they're 30 years old.
Yeah.
There are very, very few things.
Not even you.
Not even me. It's older than me.
I wish I could say that.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice? All right, let's do some robot news because it's been too long. First off, this is more of a geek bit in the sense that you got to see the video, but basically in Japan, a $50,000 robot's being sold. It's agricultural, and got a guess on what it does?
Well, I know.
Oh.
I could give you a guess that's wrong.
Okay, yeah, give a guess that's wrong. No, it's a strawberry picking robot, of course. And it looks like it picks a strawberry if the strawberry is dangling free form below the plant, so you have to actually have the plants lifted up, and it has to be, and it has a color sensor so it knows, and then it squeezes the fruit to find out if it's ripe, I'm assuming.
Oh my gosh.
Right? And it cuts it off. But it looks like it picks a strawberry every, I don't know, 20 seconds or so?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's slow compared to human beings. $50,000, and it's got to have a track. It's basically, that's state of the art. That's exciting. Blah. I saw a lot of news stories this week, which I was unimpressed by. Another one is, one of the apps with the elephant. What is that? The note reminding. Evernote has a new merger with 3M where they're selling Post-it notes that are specially labeled to be Forever Note. And you write down on a Post-it note the paper ones that are yellow and pink and all that. And then you can take a picture of it with your Evernote app. And then it will digitize it for you. And that was the story? I'm like, what? That's not a story. That's marketing.
You know,
it's
I do have to
junk.
Say, in defense of the robots, not that it's in defense of the robots, in defense of the
they need
people
your help.
Who
they
build the robots.
Sad. Yes.
Building a robot is really hard. You know, it's kind of, it's crazy.
Yeah, building robots is awesome and great.
Well, when you think about the things that, my partner and I are starting a garden, and I direct seeded some beets last night. So I just like punched a little hole half an inch into the ground.
With your finger.
With my finger, and I put a seed in there, and I covered it up, and I put water on it.
That's not as exciting as having a $50,000 robot.
And without doing hardly anything, there's going to be an edible beet. Now, all of the things that go into creating that beet are so, they're orders of magnitude beyond anything that we could possibly hope to do with our current technology, right? I mean, we're working to try to emulate nature. We're working to try to emulate things that have been created by nature or abilities that humans have with all of our evolution and everything. So, like, of course, a strawberry picking robot's going to be way less impressive than a human being. But the fact that I find that humans created something that can kind of start to do the things that we can do, that's kind of amazing. But in terms of functionality, no. It's like, who's going to buy a $50,000 strawberry picking robot that can pick one every 20 seconds, you know?
Of course, it's just the start of the tech, but I just think it's kind of ridiculous. Now, another thing I thought was, I wanted to talk about the consumer line robots real quick. Just, I saw a new commercial product called iStir, and this is basically a crock pot that has a stirring device in the middle of it. And that's a robot, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in some sense, it operates by its own accord. You can kind of start it, and, you know, a crock pot that stirs, sure, that's cool. But it's like, that's the duality we have. We have a robot that's $50,000 that doesn't really work in normal conditions but might be useful, and clearly it makes sense that people in Japan are making it because they always seem to make the let's make robots do everything, which is awesome.
And then a robot that's 1/1,000th of the price.
Right. That just stirs stuff. And then it's like, wait, you need to stir things in a crock pot? No, you don't. Like, what? And the other thing about that, of course, is that the motor for it's on top of the crock pot. So the motor's going to get baked with the food, right? Because it's going to be above it. So being, well, that's not good. And then, of course, the whole thing with the crock pot for me is I want one that was made 30 years ago and is still operational. Because then I know when I leave the house, it won't burn the house down. I don't want one that has a transistor where they don't even know where they sourced that part, right? It just came somewhere. It was the cheapest. It was the 2-cent part rather than the 4-cent part. And that thing's going to burn up at some point and burn my house down. So the idea of actually also having a motor that could potentially get jammed and overheat. And how does it know if it's overheating? It's already hot. Ugh, so frustrating.
You've thought a lot about this.
Only
for a few seconds.
Your crock pot.
I do have to say, so I was just on a farm. And it was just absolutely incredible. The machinery that they use on this farm, it's all pulled by horses, and you can see exactly how every single part of it works because all the parts are big enough that you can see it.
Roger, what do you think about your son becoming a Luddite? He's going to farms. He's planting stuff by hand. He didn't even use a spade. I mean, come
on. I never know from week to week what Ben's doing.
You know, I want to go into more of that, and I'll go into more robot story. Lindsay's got a robot story in just a second, kind of. And but first, do stay tuned. This is Geek Speak. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe, Roger Jaffe, and Lindsay Lonnie. This is Geek Speak. You can learn everything about Geek Speak by going to geekspeak.org. We put up notes about every show. We've got archive going back for years, and you can listen to hours and hours of us blabbing on about technology. Also on KOSP, the 7th Avenue Project. In 1810, James Tilly Matthews described a sinister political plot using the latest technologies to influence public opinion and plunge England into war. He was branded a lunatic and sent to the notorious Bedlam Insane Asylum. But was Matthews really bonkers, or was he just ahead of his time? Historian Mike Jay says Matthews' dark vision of technology-assisted conspiracy has become a defining myth of our age. How reality caught up with paranoid delusions on the next 7th Avenue Project, which is tomorrow here on KOSP and also available at kosp.org. Geek Bits are a little bit of geek techno stuff we talk about that you got to see to believe, and Ben, you're starting.
Yeah, actually, this is one you have to hear to believe. It's a Radio Lab episode, actually. Radiolab is a fantastic podcast. We've talked about it many times on the show. I'd highly recommend you guys go and subscribe. I just want to push one of their podcast episodes called Speed, and it's absolutely fantastic. It talks about speed in all sorts of different contexts, including high-speed trading. And the reason I'm thinking about this is because a week and a half ago on Wednesday, the Fed announced a surprise decision in the way that they were going to handle different things. I don't really know anything about the stock market, so I'm not going to cover this story. But basically, within the 7 milliseconds for that information to pass from where it was announced to Chicago's futures market, somebody put in a whole bunch of orders and things like that, and basically somewhere around $600 million of assets changed hands within those couple milliseconds. Wow. Like within the 7 milliseconds.
Definitely, they cover that a lot on the Radiolab Speed episode. Yeah, absolutely.
Which is about the time it takes a bumblebee to flap its wings one time. So like within that, things change so fast because of this automatic speed.
Yeah, Radiolab is an amazing job at visualizing and sharing stuff through radio.
They also talk about the speed of neurons and pain neurons. It's an awesome episode. It's just a wonderful episode.
All right, let's do a visual geek bit now too. Lindsay?
Sure. So let me scroll down here. Give me a second.
We need the Jeopardy theme handy.
Dun, 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 dun. You wanted to talk about the Lego thing?
Yeah.
All right. So let me, sorry.
More scrolling.
I know. I wasn't prepared. So there's a book that's coming out that has photographs, amazing photographs of the creations that people have made with Legos. It has stuff like post 9/11 sites, huge homes, spacecrafts, things like that. But it's super beautiful the way they photographed everything with dark backgrounds and made it, you know, the lighting just perfect. But yeah, that's something that we'll put a link up on the site so you can take a look at.
All right. And another geek bit that I'll just mention quick. You've got an infograph of the day, basically sci-fi.
Yeah. So if you've ever seen ships on sci-fi, you know, you've got like the Millennium Falcon there on your
it's
laptop.
On my computer. Yeah.
Exactly. You don't really have an idea of scale sometimes with different shows. So there's like Babylon 5. There's, you know,
Star Trek, Star Wars, multiple versions, Warhammer.
Warhammers.
Yeah.
Right. And so Firefly. It's just a big poster, like an infographic, where you can see the size and scale of all the different ships,
nice.
The names of them, the models and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I've seen stuff like that before, but this one is super elaborate and has a lot of stuff you wouldn't expect to see.
And all these Geek Bits things you want to hear and see and links and such are available at geekspeak.org at the end of the show. Okay, we were talking about robots. Lindsay, you got a short story about a really expensive robot that's now available in Japan.
Yes. So that's the one I was looking at.
Yes, sorry about that.
The current test vehicle that they have. So there's a bunch of people working this autonomous car thing. Like we've seen the Google car driving around, you know, there's always somebody in the car. It's not necessarily legal in most places to have a completely autonomous car, but Japan has legalized having a passenger in a car and the autonomous cars like we have here in California with the Google cars. Tesla is also working on coming out with something in about 3 years that has a similar kind of thing. And the idea currently is not to have the cars drive themselves. It's more like a really advanced autopilot.
Yeah.
And what Nissan is doing with these cars is their goal is to stop fatalities caused by their cars due to sloppy human driving. So this car can keep a car in its own lane. So like people that are texting or, you know, not paying attention, trying to type in their laptop, it'll keep the car in its lane. It will change lanes to pass slower vehicles. It can prepare to exit a freeway. It'll automatically slow down for congestion up ahead. And what I think is cool is it automatically stops at red lights. So those are, you know, some of the major fatalities that happen are people not paying attention and doing those kinds of things.
So this is not necessarily autonomous, but assisted.
Right. And it has the capacity. They are saying by 2020 that this will be standard in the cars to prevent accidents.
That's pretty awesome.
Like
that. So now it's got its license to drive in Japan.
Exactly.
You can buy one in Japan and actually have a vehicle like this that assists you in driving.
And I have a feeling that there will be autonomous capabilities, but that the laws around that and just, you know, acceptance is going to be the issue.
Yeah,
it's
really
cool. Willing to accept it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of just an extension of something like anti-lock brakes.
What I was thinking too. Right. There's been assisted driving.
Or power steering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what? It's not directly connected. That's not okay.
You know, I got to say that assisted brakes are a little more creepy than power lock, right? I mean, the assisted brakes are, we're going to operate the car better than you can. Just trust us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good. Fast. They work well. You know, I mean, I totally support it. I'm sure there's lots of accidents that haven't happened because of them. But it is like, you're not good enough.
But the only reason it's disconcerting is because we don't understand how bad we are at things.
Yes.
Right? That plus arrogance. I mean,
speaking of being bad, what about texting, Ben?
Oh, yeah. So I mean, humans text while they drive. Unfortunately, it's really horrible. And it leads to a lot of fatalities every year and injuries.
I pull over a lot to text.
Yeah.
Good. That's I'm what glad. I do. I'm People
like, should. Of course, I'm not on the freeway a lot of times because I take mountain roads. So I pull over and I'm like texting, and like 5 minutes later, I'm like, I'm going to be late if I don't get on the road again.
Go on. Well, at least you pull over. So, I mean, a lot of thought has been given to how do we get people to stop texting. So, you know, we passed a law saying that there's this massive fine. Well, actually, not so massive. It should be more massive fine that, you know, if you're found texting while you're driving, then, you know, da 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 da. That doesn't really work. So, actually, there's this really great campaign. Actually, it's not even a campaign. It's being done in New York. So the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, announced that they are deploying some signs that say it can wait text stop 5 miles. So all the rest stops eventually will be rest and text stops. So you can pull off on the rest stops. And not only that, but there will be signs saying, hey, if you want to text, wait, you know? So yeah. The thing that I love about this is that before we were saying texting while driving is dangerous and costly. Don't do it, period, right?
Right.
But this, I think, is going to appeal more to human psychology in saying, yeah, we know you want to text. Do it, just not right now.
Right. It's,
do it in a... And that's
it's like the abstinence training. It really is the same type of thing, right? Like, we know you're going to do it anyway. So let's give you spaces where it's safer to do it. Like stopped at a rest stop.
Like stopped at a rest stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really probably more excited about this than I should be. I love public transportation and public signage and like all the problems associated with that.
No, it's okay to text on a bus, right? If you're not driving?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You love the idea of...
I love it. You know, I mean, another idea that phone makers were throwing around and haven't done, as far as I know, is when the vehicle is in motion, when the phone knows that you're moving, it won't let you. But what if you're a passenger? What if you're on a bus? You know, like all of those questions pop up. So it's not don't do it. It's do it safely.
Yeah.
So I like that.
Very cool. Ben, you've got a whole bunch of other stories. I want to let you get to one before we start inviting calls. And I'm curious about this iOS. You don't use an iPhone.
No, I don't. But I know quite a few people who do, actually. One is, you use an iPhone, right, Dad?
I use an iPhone.
So how do you like iOS 7? The update?
The updating was difficult. What I found is don't update if you're at an internet place where they block ports. Because I
like
tried
at schools.
That. Like schools. Because the update will fail. And I took mine to the Apple store because I thought my iPad was broken. And it wasn't. And it updated just fine. I should have just gone home and tried it. So I found that out the hard way.
Yeah.
You know, it's just different. And I think I just have to get used to it. And I did notice one thing that if you hold it and you kind of move it around,
a parallax
things
thing,
yeah. move.
Yeah, yeah, there's a parallax
thing. And it's
thing.
Like, whoa, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, because we're on the radio and it's kind of hard to show using our hands, if you look at something nearby and you look at something further away and you move your head from side to side, you'll notice that they move with respect to each other. That's how animals, including us, see three dimensions, one of the ways at least. So iOS 7 has some parallax involved. As you tilt the phone around, the background and the icons move with respect to each other. So it almost looks like there's a depth in the screen.
They're more also, specifically, the icons in the front do not move with respect to the phone, but the background image does
yes.
move in the opposite direction slightly from the inertia. So it looks like they're free-floating. It looks like there's three-dimensionality to the screen.
Yep. Absolutely, which is really, I have to say, it's a really, really neat feature. It's really beautiful, but people are getting sick. I mean, there's actually a story saying
what do you mean people are getting sick? Why
iOS 7 is making some users sick. I mean, basically there are there's
Roger,
parallax.
Can I see the phone?
Yeah,
it's
so,
really quite cool, but you can't do it for very long.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, because your eyes just kind of what is that? It's weird. We're used to a screen, which is a flat thing, being flat. But when it looks like it's not and it tricks your physiology, especially if you're using one eye to look at it and you don't have both eyes with the parallax built into that.
What are you trying to say,
it's
Ben?
Strange. So there's
oh, wow.
So there's that. there's a bunch of fake zooms where they'll zoom into an icon to go into the application. But it's just, to me, it's a little bit jarring because I'm used to not looking at a phone. I kind of try to avoid using my phone. I like the real world.
I love that people are getting sick from it.
But yeah, I mean,
in a sense that this is good. No, I mean that, hey, let's have a new feature. And people are like, ugh.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, some people will notice that just on their own, or they'll become a little bit dizzy or something right. like that, especially if you're using the phone a lot or switching applications a lot. But also people with vestibular disorders. I mean, it's even more difficult for people with medical conditions, with certain medical
conditions.
Can
you turn these features off?
Yes, you can. At least most of them. Yeah, you can.
Okay.
So that's good. But okay, I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, from a software development perspective, I understand you build a really cool looking thing, and then you want to deploy it, right?
Right.
But the problem is, if you have millions and millions and millions of users, you can't anticipate things like this as easily. And if you do, there's going to be something else you don't anticipate.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
kind of the problem with a big release like that. Plus the fact that people don't like change. There's a YouTube video going around of some kid freaking out because his iPad looks different.
4-year-old kid crying.
Yeah. and I mean, you can't really go back so easily. And
no.
even if you can, you can't just stay on an old OS. Forever.
I've been, Ben, while you've been gone farming in Maine, I've switched to an Android device so that I can sync my Google Glass to my Android device. And I've gotten text messages during the show.
You just got one
a few minutes ago. Yeah. That was a news update. I actually get a lot of that kind of forced fed stuff. I'm not sure if I like it or not, but I always try things.
I do not like
Android compared to iOS. iOS, yeah. I'm more comfortable with it. So I still have my iPhone 4.
Yeah.
Primary, and I don't have it as a cell device, but I use it as a Wi-Fi device, and I use the apps, and I'm interacting with both devices a lot. There are things that are a little different, and there are things I like about Android, but a lot of the experience is it's just not as complete, but it's definitely more flexible. Right now, if my Google Glass like got destroyed or something, or there was an app on the iPhone, I would switch over to iOS quick. I'd go back over really quick.
Yeah.
But I do like the idea that I'm forcing myself to kind of experience it and see the benefit and stuff. And there's a few things I do like the flexibility. All right. Thanks for the iOS making people sick thing. It's fun.
I don't mean to sound like a curmudgeon.
Yeah.
Change isn't always bad. And, sometimes people just need a little time.
You know, there's one other thing about iOS 7, though, is that the people that I've had complaints about that I know personally are the people that have the older phones and they upgraded the software. All the people that have the new phone, like the iPhone 5S, they love it. Absolutely love it. It's fast. It's snappy. It's all great. Came with the operating system. And of course, that's the one that they primarily test on and have experience with. And the thumbprint thing works. It's really neat. I mean, I've seen it. I tried, I didn't make a casting of a friend's thumb, but I definitely tried my thumb. It didn't work. And that was kind of cool. Anyway, but there are security vulnerabilities that are kind of inherent to the system on the iOS 7. In fact, right now, you can't actually effectively lock the phone. Anybody can pick it up and get into it with a few simple steps. Even with the sensor and the lock screen, you can get past
it. Really?
That's a big flaw. They'll fix it soon.
Yeah.
All right. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Roger Jaffe. He's a high school teacher in math and science and engineering. And we also have Ben Jaffe. Of course, Ben's a regular on Geek Speak. And Lindsay Lonnie. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. Lindsay, what's going on in Sudan?
So there's been days of demonstrations in Sudan now, and they shut off the internet, trying to get people activists unable to organize. So some geeky people got together and created an app that when SMS messages are sent by activists on the ground, they record a location, verify the stories that are being told of what's happening in that location, and then post it to a shared map that can be accessible via cellular service. So it's sort of a social, they've created kind of a social app for this. Let's see, it's called the Abina Crowd Map, and it allows people to report killings, detainees, fire, deconstruction, and demonstrations. So if you wanted to demonstrate, you could find where people are demonstrating, and it's just kind of keeping people in the loop so that they can get to where they need to be. And I just think it's a cool use for that kind of
technology.
Is it
an Android?
They didn't say I think that they were having trouble getting phone and Skype.
They were having trouble with their internet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they just had information. They have a website up for the Abena crowd map, but it doesn't have a ton of details. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you can get more information from, you know, if you're in the heat of it down there.
Yeah.
Word of mouth. But
I guess one of the things, since I was talking about Android versus iOS, one thing I love about Android environments is you log in with Chrome, with your Google account. You can go and install stuff on your phone through a normal desktop machine, right? You just go and say, I want this app on my phone or my tablet, whatever. And it then does that on your phone. Like the connectivity between the desktop environment, which I prefer doing stuff on, and the mobile device is much easier in the Android environment. So anyway, I was looking to see if I could find an app, right, to install it.
Right.
Definitely a benefit. So cool. Just more support about, you know, the social impact of these tools. So anyway, thank you very much for the story on Sedan. Ben, got anything about I don't know, natural science stuff?
I do. I have one space news and one biology news. The space news is that one of the rings of Saturn got whacked by some cosmic debris of some sort, right? And that's the F ring. That's the outermost discrete ring of Saturn. It's very faint. But luckily, we have a satellite called the Cassini probe. Kind of orbiting around Saturn.
Can I ask you about clarity?
Please.
Are you talking about when you look at Saturn's rings close up from one of these probes, you can see segregations in different zones?
Absolutely.
Those actually have names.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so this would be like the farthest one that has separation from visual separation, basically.
So when you look at Saturn through a medium-powered telescope, you see the rings, but you think of the rings as a thing. But in reality, they're actually several different rings.
And in fact, they're just a whole bunch of particles.
Rings are actually just made up of a ton of small particles of ice and rock and dust and stuff like that.
Right.
So apparently there are actually pretty frequent collisions with Saturn's ring, but we got a pretty cool picture of it.
Cool.
So that's up. That'll be up at geekspeak.org. And then the other thing is I've always been interested in circadian rhythms, and that's the rhythm, the biological mechanism inside of you and inside of other animals that keeps you in sync with the rest of the world, right? It mainly looks at the sun rising and the sun setting. And so when it's light versus when it's dark, you tend to want to do different things. Humans, for example, release melatonin when it gets dark and then you fall asleep. We actually have documented a lot of animals that have non-circadian rhythms, so rhythms that go based off of things like the tides, or actually one based off of the moon. But there have actually been two papers that have been published just within this last week that document that it's not the same mechanism that does the circadian rhythms that does some of these other non-circadian rhythms. So there's the two examples that they give, these two different papers, which actually were completely separate research groups. One is a sea louse, and their swimming patterns sync up with the tides. And then one is a marine worm, and it matures and spawns in concert with the phases of the moon. So that's pretty cool. Pretty interesting article as well.
Yeah. I think a lot about circadian rhythms now that I'm traveling back and forth all the time. I get messed up all the time.
Absolutely.
But it's like it's all about trying to trick my physiology, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Light and movement and diet. Like that's the kind of things I try to vary.
Melatonin can help too. If you take melatonin at the right time, then...
Oh, really?
Yeah, because when it gets dark, your body releases melatonin. So if you can take melatonin and trick your body into thinking that it's dark-ish, it doesn't knock you out like the sleeping pills do.
Yeah, I don't.
But it makes
that,
it easier to fall asleep. So
that's cool. Yeah. What I find fascinating about it is that when you, I can function fine. I can wake up. I can move my body and eat and participate in speech, but I'm not thinking as well.
Mm-mm.
I see in retrospect, like, wow, the notes I took yesterday are just like me
impaired.
Dictating what was happening. I wasn't thinking about it. It's robotic in a lot of nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you go through conversations and realize, wait, what are we talking about?
The experience has made me be very conscious of my parental roles of getting my kids to sleep on time, right? So like now I'm much more focused on like, let's get them as much sleep as possible. Because if I'm messed up like this and they're going to school and they're not getting enough sleep, it's the same type of thing. They're just not at their optimum space.
Yeah.
So cool. Thank you for that story.
Yeah.
Lindsay, you want to fill us in on...
Sure.
Yeah.
Google's open project.
Yes. That's the one.
So we've been hearing about the Chromecast and there's AirPlay, you know, these things that you can plug in. And
I don't know much about the Chromecast.
It's a USB thing, and you plug it in. Let's say you have your Android phone and you can plug that thing into your Blu-ray player, your television, something like that. You can open an app on your phone, and it will show on your TV monitor. And so you can share your phone pictures and things like that. And I think there's going to be more of that kind of stuff. And the Chromecast thing was, you know, they released it and it was really cheap. It was like $35. And so people were just snapping them up so that they could try it out.
Yeah, yeah.
So open project, it makes me feel a little proud of my intuition, because a while back I was having a discussion with somebody and I said, you know, I think the future is that we'll all have this tiny little device that we carry around that's like our little pocket computer, like our smartphones are turning into, and that there's just going to be monitors everywhere. And you can just project what you want onto your onto whatever monitor is nearby,
yeah,
whether it's like a rollout or projection or, you know, anything like that. And so what the open project does is it allows you to project whatever's going on with your phone or your device and project it onto any monitor. So the idea of the openness is that you can project onto any monitor, and the touchscreen, it's designed for use with touchscreen monitors.
Cool.
So you can be looking at it or playing a game on your phone, project it onto whatever monitors at your friend's house or touchscreen, you mm-hmm. know, and then they can interact with it as well.
Nice.
So, you know, you can just share.
So this is a project by Google, because of course the tech's not actually ubiquitous yet. I'm assuming the Chromecast device would do something like this, but
right.
the idea is all, I mean, that's an awesome idea. Good job, Lindsay.
Thank you.
That of course, I mean, it's always that problem of trying to tether and connect. And I remember years ago when Apple was doing it with just their devices, you know, even with music, they did it with the small Wi-Fi access points that you could beam your iTunes library to, and you could plug that into your stereo, and just the idea of being able to do that inherently.
Yeah.
And now it's getting more there, but it's always trapped by the company that does it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Apple stuff works together and Sony's stuff kind of works together, and it seems to me that definitely needs to be a project that is more open. So that's cool. That's what Google's working on.
One other thing is that's different about it is it uses a QR code to pair
oh, cool.
with the other device, and then it actually runs whatever's running on the monitor or the other device so that you are not hogging up all resources on your phone, things like that. So I'm not exactly sure how that's going to work, but I'm
yeah.
sure it'll unfold, and I'll keep reporting on that.
I love this because like, the way you're talking about this now, clearly it's going to happen. It's going to move forward in that direction. We're going to see it occur. And I remember like the first talks about USB or the first talks about serial drives versus parallel drives and mm-hmm. on GeekSpeak over the years, you know. And so hearing about it first, go, oh, wouldn't that be cool if you could like daisy chain serial devices, like have lots of serial devices attached to one port? That'd be so great. And you wouldn't have to deal with interrupt requests and stuff. Oh, gosh, it's such a pain to do that. Well, it's better than Windows 98 because you can do auto. Yeah, that's true. That's auto. But it's so hard. And then, you know, now we have USB. We don't even think about it. I chain things together all the time. Every time I do it, I'm like, nah, 5 volts, ubiquitous, and it works. Uh-huh. So nice. Of course, my kids have no idea. It's cool.
Mm-hmm.
So that'd be great to have the ability to just use any screen anytime you want, especially when I'm sitting in front of touch screens. Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
All right, thanks. All right, let's talk about technology failing.
Sure. So we've had plenty of stories about Apple Maps failing, but I have yet another one.
Oh, good.
So on September 6th and September 20th, these are two separate incidents. People tried to navigate to Fairbanks Airport, and the directions from Apple Maps took them right past the parking lot and onto the taxiway of the airport. Now, to be fair, this is also driver's error. A lot of it.
Yeah, you'd think.
So here's a quote from the airport's assistant manager, Angie Spear. She said, "They must have been persistent. They had to enter the airport property via a motion-activated gate, and afterwards there are many signs, lights, and painted markings, first warning that aircraft may share the road, and then that drivers should not be there at all. They needed to drive over a mile with all this before reaching the runway, but drivers disregarded all of that because they were following directions given on their iPhones."
Wait, they really did this?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
But how does a person just drive onto an airfield? I thought it was like security kind of things.
Small airports, I guess. And also, beyond that, I should also say that Apple Maps didn't actually take them onto the runway. They just took them to the taxiway right by there. But even with that, two drivers drove across the runway.
Wow.
And so they complained to Apple and all
See,
of that.
This is
they
the
put
argument,
up a whole bunch of barricades.
This
to
is the argument
it.
Against your phone just being smart for you and
yeah.
you not making decisions. Like, that's horrible.
Absolutely.
Was it an autonomous car? No,
yeah, if it was an autonomous car. Too.
So anyway, that's up in Alaska.
There is an airport where the road does go across the runway.
That's intentional?
It's intentional. It's in Gibraltar.
Is it
if
really?
You look it up on Google Maps, you see the runway and you see the road goes right across it.
I'm assuming there's stoplights.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Serious security and crossing issues there.
Oh, man. So anyway, so now if you search for directions, you're told that directions are not available.
Charles de Gaulle in Paris, you do a lot of traveling across the runway on these giant, like, three-story buses. And then also you go under, like, there's a lot of going under where the planes go. So you're, like, driving along, and all of a sudden you shoot down, and the plane goes above you, like, on the road, on the ground.
Oh, my gosh. I really love...
And everyone speaks French there. It's very strange.
What is this world? Anyway, I really like going under the runway. I can't remember what airport I was in, but you walk along. You can see you're walking towards the runway, and then you go down steps, and you walk through this tunnel.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And it's just weird to think that these planes are above you when you're in this tunnel.
Speaking of maps, though, one of the things that I need to do all the time when I'm in Europe is get offline maps. So I'm always looking for a good offline map app, and it's really frustrating. And the other day... I think it was just like yesterday or so, I thought, you know, Google should probably have this feature in Google Maps.
They do.
And they do. Mm-hmm. It's just hard to find. So when you find a spot in Google Maps, you get an area that you want to have captured. You just kind of zoom out to the right amount. I'm talking about an Android Google Maps app. It might work on iOS as well. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And once you're there, you then go into the search bar area. And the interface comes at the very bottom of that. You can say save this for offline, and it works great.
It used to be a lot easier to find, but then
it's hard to find.
It's hard to find now.
You have to know it's there.
Yeah,
I'll find a story on how to do that. All right. Well, I've got another thing. Since I'm talking about France, I might as well keep going. Looks like so Google's implementing a privacy policy changes, and the CNIL, which is a French watchdog group, basically is saying that they're not complying by European law. And so they're suggesting a fine of €150,000, which is like $202,000, something like that. Not a lot of money for Google. And Google, of course, is saying, no, we're totally compliant. Our privacy policy respects European law and all that. We're just trying to make things simpler and more effective. And the thing is that's really interesting is that the feeling of what privacy is, where the boundary is just different in different cultures. And so Google's Americanized stance doesn't fit well with the French or maybe even broadly European aesthetic about privacy. And so there's this problem emerges by a cultural distinction in my mind. Anyway, CNIL regulators disagree, and they say, on the last day of the 3-month time period given to Google Inc., the company contested the reasoning followed by the CNIL and notably the applicability of the French data protection law to the services used by residents in France. So basically they're saying, no, you messed up. You didn't do it in time. The thing that's so interesting is that the amount of money we're talking about here is so minuscule. Like, Google doesn't care about $202,000. They spend that much money finding a new employee, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nothing to them. So the idea that But what I like about this is if they do get fined, then presumably that at least kind of stamps you're doing something wrong in the European market. Mm. My hope is that design and aesthetic would broadly move more to the States where we're less concerned about privacy. And of course, probably the Snowden and all that has caused us to be more concerned about privacy. Mm-hmm. All right. Another geek bit from somebody or geek story?
I've got some. Yeah. Quantum computing stuff that it was a little bit interesting. Scientists at Harvard fired photons, which are particles of light that normally pass through each other without interacting. They fired them into a vacuum containing a cloud of extremely cold rubidium atoms to take advantage of an effect called the Rydberg blockade. And what left the chamber was observed photonic molecule. So when these photons interact with each other, they're pushing against and then deflecting each other. And so you could see it as maybe future lightsaber or something like that. But
that's the lightsaber story. I saw the cool pictures of.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's making matter from the photon. I'm making a molecule from the photons.
Right.
I'm assuming it's short-lived.
Yeah, I'm assuming so too. Yeah. They didn't put that in the article, but I'm assuming so. I'll try to find a better version of the article. But the photonic molecules would be more likely to advance quantum computing than become, a weapon or a lightsaber or anything like that.
It's much more about, this is a new way to interact with matter. and
exactly.
energy.
Exactly.
Very cool.
Because photons remain the best possible means to carry quantum information.
Yeah.
But they hadn't found a way before to get them to interact with each other, but until now. So they know that they can get them to interact, and so it could have other practical applications for chip makers, like converting light into electric signals.
You know, it's interesting. I kind of steered away from the story. I love that you handled it well. It's such a difficult thing to do, because as soon as you try to start talking about metaphor with quantum, it breaks, right? You cannot have analogy in our brain of what's actually happening. So we try to make up like photon molecules. Well, I have an idea of what a molecule is, which is wrong already.
Right. Yeah.
That's not really what it is. So it's really neat to hear the kind of boundary of how we can talk about it.
I mean, that's the world, though. We understand the world through metaphor.
Yeah.
Everything
mm-hmm.
we know about science, math, most of it at least.
Yeah.
It's all metaphor. So
I have another short mention. I mean, there's this software called Declara.
Declara? What does it do?
It's a corporate networking of skill sets. So if you have a skill set, it'll help you out finding other people that can train you.
So more information about everything we talk about, including that story that Lindsay just shared, is available at geekspeak.org. This has been GeekSpeak for September 28th, 2013. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. This is 889 KOSP Public Radio and KOSP.org. To find out more about the show, go to geekspeak.org. On the episode today was Ben Jaffe, his father Roger Jaffe, Lindsay Lonnie, and I'm Lyle Troxell. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3 license, which means you can do anything you'd like with it as long as you share.